This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Ethiopians began observing 3 days of mourning Monday, one day after a celebration known as Iricha, marking the end of the rainy season, left at least 52 people dead in the rest of Oromia region. The trouble happened during a police confrontation with anti-government protesters.
That's Jill Craig reporting. Details next.
Also, the UN says growing xenophobia is putting at risk the lives of tens of thousands of refugees fleeing war and persecution.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Ethiopians have begun observing 3 days of mourning one day after a confrontation between police and protesters left at least 52 people dead. It happened in the Oromia region after a celebration known as Iricha that marked the end of the rainy season. Jill Craig reports the region has seen deadly anti-government protests for nearly a year.
The festivities in the town of Bishoftu took an ominous tone when police used force to disperse protesters, thousands of whom were chanting against the government. According to witnesses, some demonstrators were trying to remove an Ethiopian flag from a stage when police began beating demonstrators and fired tear gas and warning shots. Panic led to a deadly stampede. Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn denied that government forces used live rounds and said some people in the crowd intended to cause chaos. Elise Dufieff is the research and monitoring manager for aid transparency group Publish What You Fund. Dufieff's PhD focused on Ethiopia.
3 days of mourning have been announced, but there's been no dialogue. It's really just like sending the army or sending the police, putting people in jail. And then deciding 3 days of mourning, and then we move on.
Human Rights Watch notes that tens of thousands of people have been arrested since November 2015, when protests in Oromia began over a government plan to annex parts of it to Addis Ababa, the capital city. Felix Horn, senior researcher on the Horn of Africa for Human Rights Watch, says these arrests are a problem.
Whenever there's a major event in Oromia, whenever there's abuses by security forces, everyone focuses on the killings. And the beatings, and rightfully so. But one thing that doesn't get a lot of attention is in the days after these protests or events like Iricha, there are large-scale arrests. And so we've been hearing today about some of the arrests that took place last night. It just continues to be a problem across Oromia.
Allowing people the right to express their concerns is key, according to Horn.
I think it's clear that the security force response to all of the protests in Oromia has been one of just using brutal force. And that not only did not work, it just actually makes the situation worse and guarantees future protests. It emboldens the protesters that are out there. So the government needs to change course, and it needs to begin looking at the very valid grievances of the protests.
In August, protests in Oromia and the Amhara region left dozens dead and hundreds injured. Opposition parties accused government security forces of opening fire on unarmed peaceful demonstrators, while the government said some of them were carrying lethal weapons like explosives and organizing unauthorized protests by forces of violence. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations is warning that the lives of tens of thousands of refugees fleeing war and persecution are at risk due to growing xenophobia. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, the site of the annual UNHCR refugee conference.
The most recent figures put the number of refugees and internally displaced people at more than 65 million. UN Refugee Chief Filippo Grandi says the gravest displacement crisis continues to be generated in Syria.
We have run out of words to describe the death, destruction, and suffering willingly inflicted on civilians by the parties to that conflict, while states with the power to stop the war are simply unable to find the unity of intent required to do so.
The exodus of people from Syria has created the biggest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. While praising Austria, Germany, and Sweden for receiving large numbers of refugees, Grandi denounces other European countries for closing their borders to those from Syria and other countries, making a chaotic situation even worse. He says the right to asylum is being undermined by xenophobia, as well as nationalistic and political rhetoric intent on linking refugees with security concerns and terrorism.
The arrival of large numbers of refugees and migrants has created panic and political instability in the global north, fueled by irresponsible politicians. Restrictions in the laws governing asylum are being enforced in many countries, even among those with a proud tradition of refugee protection and human rights.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told delegates at the conference he is outraged by the bitter injustice of war.
The situation in Syria is one of the most dramatic and tragic in the world. And we must also remember the millions of other refugees from Yemen, Afghanistan, Burundi, Central African Republic, South Sudan, and beyond. More than six decades ago,
Ban says the world has a responsibility to confront the reality of the staggering numbers of men, women, and children being killed and wounded by war. He says if there is a will and compassionate leadership, the problem of war and forcible displacement can be solved. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. In related news, today is the third anniversary of a migrant boat tragedy on the Mediterranean in which 366 people died. The incident brought world attention to the growing migrant and refugee crisis in Europe. Today, on that anniversary, AFP reports 2,600 migrants have been rescued from numerous vessels off the coast of Libya. Italian officials say about 700 people were crammed onto a single fishing boat.
In other migrant news, when the polls closed on Hungary's controversial migrant referendum yesterday, turnout appeared to be lower than the 50% needed to validate the ballot. Ruling party officials still praise the vote as a victory for people who reject European Union dominance, but some analysts say the ballot is a stark reminder of how anti-migrant sentiment is chipping away at the strength of the European Union. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more from Moraholm, Hungary.
When the polls opened in this quiet town Sunday, voters trickled in, many happy to report they voted no because they do not want refugees or migrants moving back in. In the fall of 2015, masses of people camped out in tents, some voters explain, and they want to be left alone.
I voted, and I voted no to migrants. There are enough people here, so forgive us, world. We're not a nation that hates foreigners, but this country should be left to itself.
Under the European Union plan, Hungary would have to take nearly 1,300 of the 160,000 asylum seekers stranded in Italy and Greece. Throughout the day, the government called, texted, and emailed voters, urging them to avoid the risk and vote no. Local leaders say the vote is critical to protect the country.
Our council and our city of Moraholm was continuously involved in the migration crisis last year for 10 months. All of our beautiful public spaces were occupied by those migrants. They put up shelters, they left garbage everywhere, and by the end, the people didn't feel safe.
Guards say the roughly 100 detainees left are expected to be deported. And some analysts say the very fact that Hungary's small population of asylum seekers is a top political priority is a sign of other problems.
The migration that has not been an issue and has been brought as a mainstream issue, the politics of fear, and then the very referendum and the execution of the referendum as a indication of the decline of democratic standards in the country.
And as Hungary waits for official results, he says, the rise of far-right politicians in other parts of Europe, growing xenophobia among the populations, and the eroding power of the European Union is increasingly a concern for the future. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Moraholm, Hungary.
Members of the world's largest conservation treaty, CITES, today struck down proposals to allow legal sales of some elephant ivory and rhino horn. Both sides of the argument try to paint this as a clear-cut issue, but as experts at the massive conference explained, it's complicated. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The deliberations were long, debate was impassioned, and votes were decisive. On Monday, members of the Convention on Illegal Trade and Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora killed proposals to legalize trade in elephant ivory and rhino horn. It was the key issue at this year's conference in Johannesburg, and one that experts say isn't as simple as the opposing campaigns made it seem. Nations with the world's largest elephant and rhino populations, among them Zimbabwe and Swaziland, argued that legal trade in these banned animal products will bring much-needed funds for conservation. The most visible opponents of this idea appealed to the heart, and as the conference began last week, hundreds of campaigners marched against the proposals, passionately calling for protection for these iconic, beloved creatures. Elephant and rhino expert Tom Milliken says love has little to do with this issue. Money matters, too. He says his organization, Traffic, sides with the majority in its decision to not allow legal sales for now.
But we are entirely sympathetic to the motivation that Swaziland has to leverage finance. And this is the rub here, that if the global community is expecting that there will be rhinos in Africa, elephants in Africa, in perpetuity, who is going to pay for that to happen? Because the finance is just not available. And the more we foreclose on the avenues of realizing finance that Africans themselves can do, sustainable utilization of resources, trade, sport hunting, these sorts of things, and we're not replacing it with other tools in a toolbox, these are countries that are cash-strapped.
The populations of these animals are equally vulnerable. The International Union for Conservation of Nature revealed that the African elephant population has dropped by about 111,000 in the last decade, the worst decline in a quarter century. Earlier this year, the IUCN reported that rhino poaching has increased for the sixth consecutive year. Jan Creamer, president of Animal Defenders International, says her group unequivocally supports banning all trade in ivory and rhino. Her argument appeals to emotion and, she says, human decency.
Human beings have to find a way to live alongside the other species that share our planet and to respect and preserve them and do the best we can to give them space to live. We don't agree with exploitation of animals for their body parts. The stories that we've heard from the people like the rangers here at this conference are heartbreaking. These animals are being driven to extinction.
The other side is equally passionate. Tanya Jacobson is a surprising advocate in favor of rhino horn sales. For starters, she's a vegetarian for ethical reasons. She works with the South Africa-based Rhino Alive campaign, which, as its name indicates, wants to harvest rhino horn without killing the animals.
Our feeling is that rhino horn is a sustainable product. It can be removed from a rhino humanely without causing any harm at all to rhinos. And based on this and based on the fact that rhino horn regrows at a rate of about 1 to 2 kilograms per year, we strongly feel that instead of having a situation where we're facing huge poaching dilemmas, that there is a sustainable conservation-based solution to the crisis.
These two species, Milliken says, come up at every CITES conference. As long as there are elephants and rhinos on this earth, the one thing everyone at this conference agrees on, they will be discussed. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib. 19 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A police confrontation with anti-government protesters has left at least 52 people dead in Ethiopia's restive Oromia region. And the UN says growing xenophobia is putting at risk the lives of tens of thousands of refugees fleeing war and persecution. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The U.S. State Department is known for its ambassadors, diplomats, and foreign policy, but there's a lesser-known but very important office within the department. It's the Bureau of Counterterrorism and Countering Violent Extremism. To find out more about the Bureau's mission, VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Acting Coordinator Justin Cibarel in New York. Here's part one of the interview.
The U.S. Department of State is organized around bureaus, regional bureaus as an example, the Africa Bureau, the European Bureau, the Middle East Bureau, the East Asia Bureau. Then you have functional bureaus. The Bureau of Counterterrorism is a bureau that works to ensure that U.S. counterterrorism objectives are represented in each of our regional and then bilateral policy initiatives.
I guess public diplomacy would be also be part of your brief as well in terms of counterterrorism efforts.
Certainly explaining our counterterrorism policy, our approach, the rationale for it, and where we stand in that effort absolutely is part of the responsibility, yes.
What is the perspective, what's the lens that you see when you have to do your job and you look out over the world?
On one level, it's an extremely challenging time. We have experienced a period of years here where you've had a rise of a number of transnational terrorist groups that have devastated a number of societies around the world, certainly in Syria and Iraq, but in Pakistan and Afghanistan, Nigeria and the region around the Lake Chad Basin, in Somalia, Yemen, Libya, many, many other regions. But on the other hand, there is a rising level of global awareness of the importance of coordination and cooperation among states. As an example, in the effort to counter Daesh in Syria and Iraq, or the collective effort to address terrorist groups elsewhere. Of course, that started with Al-Qaeda after 9/11, and we have a growing infrastructure of international cooperation against terrorism.
When you say we, I'm wondering, you know, what the particular slice of this interagency and international effort is in terms of State Department.
Well, terrorism is a challenge that generally is addressed by national measures. So in other words, governments take care of the terrorism problem in a domestic context. Their law enforcement, or in some cases, a military, the security agencies that identify and then deal with terrorism threats within their borders. But as we know, terrorism groups do not recognize borders. They work across borders. They infect a region in some cases. So you really have to have international cooperation and coordination, and that's absolutely the role of diplomacy. It comes up in the area as an example of preventing terrorists from traveling from one country to another, or from moving money from one country to another, or getting arms from one country to another. That takes international cooperation, and so that's where the role of diplomacy is absolutely vital.
But isn't community grassroots cooperation among peoples also important?
Terrorist groups really exploit the seams in a society. So to the degree that communities and people can come together to develop resilience and stronger communities that develop effective and constructive relations with their local and municipal state level and national governments and advocate effectively for their concerns, that builds a stronger society that is more resilient against the challenges of terrorism. So
you talk about conflict, for example. Is it part of your brief to shore up economies and to quell disaffection politically, economically, that could result in terrorism, or do you sort of let everybody do it locally?
Conflict releases all kinds of very unfortunate consequences. Refugee flows, internally displaced people, poverty, of course, disruptions to an economy, environmental degradation. Conflict often provides effectively a safe haven within which terrorist groups can grow and begin to develop. From the counterterrorism perspective, we tend to focus on the more immediate, but there's a growing realization that we need to prevent terrorism and get ahead of it. And that means addressing the fundamental drivers. They could be actual, you know, military conflict, but they could also be a marginalization of one community in a society. They could be state practices that repress a particular group that then causes them to look to confront a government, including through asymmetric or terrorist means. So in those areas where development would be helpful and development projects would be helpful to address a particular set of circumstances that may be leading to radicalization and terrorism, absolutely, there's a key role there.
That was Justin Cibarel, acting coordinator for the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Counterterrorism. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. In part two of our series, Cibarel addresses counterterrorism strategies in Africa.
South African President Jacob Zuma says recent violent protests over university tuition fee increases have caused $44 million in property damage. He says the protests threaten to sabotage the higher education system. Mr. Zuma told an audience at the University of Cape Town that the country must unite to save the system. He announced a government plan to pay tuition increases for more than 75% of students. Only students who come from households earning less than $44,000 a year will be eligible. Student protests forced several universities to close in the last 2 weeks. Demonstrators threw stones at police, who fired tear gas and rubber bullets at the crowds. During Mr. Zuma's address, two entrances to the University of Cape Town were closed because of protests. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
This is our moment. Together with footballers like Steven Pienaar, we are speaking out to end malaria.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Sleep under an insecticide-treated mosquito net every night. Go to a health center at the first sign of fever for testing and appropriate treatment.
Let's do it.
United, we can beat malaria.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best.
Yes, sir. Two-Face, NATO C. Hey.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.